Hello and welcome to Cult Pix Radio, WCPX 66.6 in the darkness. For all you podcast fanatics, late night owls, and for those long, long, late night drives to have a soothing voice to lull you asleep. That voice belongs to me, Django Nudo.
And me, as always, the funny sidekick, the smut peddler.
Igor, yes. Good to have you back. Yes, you've been busy because you've discovered an exciting new streaming service, Smut Peddler. What have you been watching?
I was quite surprised because I have had a lot of time on my hands in the evenings, and I couldn't find anything to watch on the big streaming services. We shall not name names, but I'm talking about basically all of them. And then I found this little new thing called Cult Pix and started watching films I really wanted to see instead of those majors where I couldn't find anything to watch.
Huh. So what have you been feasting on?
So I started out with a trio of fantasy films. So I've seen, I watched Amazon's Gore and Beastmaster.
Beastmaster, yes. So it's 80s
and all of them are quite similar. They're 80s fantasy movies with a really silly dialogue, really silly storyline, and just super enjoyable. And followed that up yesterday with Star Crash, which was also like super fun. Mm-hmm. And also for all our listeners and viewers out there, don't forget that you can comment on all of the films on Cult Pix.
Yes, and you're very good in adding line notes, for example, from Something Weird Video when we have one of their films. A couple of industry news, things to get through. I shared with you that Disney is going to stop releasing DVDs and Blu-rays in a major market in Australia. It feels like they could be testing the water of getting rid of physical media distribution of films altogether, which is a kind of worrying trend that we've seen elsewhere.
I still think that the sort of avid collectors, that would be a niche market, but I think that the mainstream market might go that way.
Well, this is what I'm worried about, because we'd hate to see the end of great labels. We do not wish to go only streaming, because there is a value in owning a film, because guess what? If it's on the DVD, nobody can mess with it. And that is a segue to the rest in peace for William Friedkin, the great director of Exorcist, French Connection, and Sorcerer, who, of course, lived long enough to see his film French Connection butchered in streaming version. And this is what shocked me when I looked back on it. It wasn't on Disney Plus or Amazon. It was on the Criterion channel that they had snipped out an extended dialogue deemed too racist.
You dumb guinea.
How the hell did I know he had a knife?
Never trust a nigger.
He could have been white.
Never trust anyone.
And Criterion channel? Really? Aren't they supposed to be, you know, art housey, respecting directors' visions? We've never, and we will never, edit out any dialogue or offending scenes.
We feel that the films should be in their original length and format, and it's up to the viewer to you know, think whatever they
Make
want
up their
about
own mind.
Yeah.
Looking ahead, what have we got coming up this next week, Smart
Yes,
Peddler?
Yes, we have we should do more previews, I think, or talk more about what's coming up, because we basically have everything planned until October, but just for next week, I think it's going to be a treat for all of you lovers of German smut.
Who doesn't love German smut?
We have a really good partner in Germany, and they had masters of the German versions of these films, but they also had tapes, Digi Beta and 1-inch C tapes of the films with English dub. And we were a bit cautious about that, but they sent them to us, and our very good friend, the tech guy, scanned them and you know, made digital copies of them, and they look excellent.
Yes, We've got brand new English language masters of these German films, which I don't know if they've ever been released other than when they were first screened in cinemas, but this could be the very first time that there's an English language dub of these films, which typically we don't have subtitles for. So either you speak German or you just appreciate the boobs or you don't watch them, but now you can enjoy them in English.
Yes, definitely. And shall we talk a bit about some of the highlights? I have one specific favorite. I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to see it. And it's so bizarre because it's the original
I know which one.
Name is Die Schulmädchen vom Treffpunkt Zoo, which means like the schoolgirls from the train station Zoo
station.
Maybe. Yeah. And in English, train station pickups. And this is a, believe it or not, a comedy in the sort of Porky's vein, but based on the German very rough and dark, gritty drama, Christiane F.
Yes. That's a bit shocking. Think of an English equivalent for people who haven't seen it, but yeah, Last Exit to Brooklyn, kind of only more grim.
Young teenagers, drugs, prostitution, you name it.
Violence, abuse. Yeah, it's got it all.
So everything.
But they made a comedy.
All the makings of a good comedy.
What else is there in this German
Smile? Yeah, then we have, of course, I love this. Well, this is a theme that we've been talking about a lot, about how Sweden was perceived as using the word Sweden or Swedish or something like that was perceived internationally as that it would be something naughty. So we have a German title, which I think translates to married couple looking for people with the same, interests or something. Ehepaar sucht gleichgesinntes.
Like-minded.
Yeah. Like-minded, thank you, yes. And, of course, the English or American title was Swedish Wife Exchange Club.
But probably enough for preview of the German films, but a big thank you, of course, to our friends at the Playmaker Munich. It is incredibly trusting of them to send us their master tapes, the only copies of these, all the way to Sweden for us to digitize them and return them. So you're in for a treat this week. Make sure not to miss it.
Yeah.
And now we turn to our good friends at Echelon Studios. They gave us so many films that even though we tried to divide them up into theme weeks, and we've got more theme weeks coming up from them, there was just so many great films that couldn't be easily slotted into anything. So we made a mixed bag out of them. Seven different films on seven different topics, all of them great, all of them beautifully restored in HD. And this is what we've been playing the last week. And though they're mixed, I discovered one common theme or thread to them, which is vaguely obscure. You might not have spotted this, but if you look on the front page of Cultpix, you'll discover that all of them, all seven films, have drawings for posters, no photos.
That's lovely. That's a very nice aspect of it, because normally from that era, there were more and more photos used, and that was kind of boring.
I know. 70s and 80s, but if you look at that, and some of them are beautifully intricate, including the second one, but really I urge you to all of them, check out all of them, because we do have the poster photos at the bottom of the page. So without further ado, one of the great posters is of Astro Zombies, 1968 from USA.
Terror stalks the streets as a scientist's human transplantation experiment runs amok. The Astro Zombies.
Tiny little horror schlocker made by Ted V. Michaels on a budget of no more than $37,000, which even back in 68 wasn't very much.
Yeah.
And almost 10% of that budget went on paying John Carradine, who appears in the film.
Right.
Mumbling. You need somebody who can mumble scientific nonsense in an authoritative way.
Yeah.
And John Carradine is your man.
A 10.6 would erase every vestige of memory from the patient's brain. He would lose mobility. He'd be totally helpless. A vegetable, so to speak. A 10.2 would leave his motor movements in the retention cells. His brain may call on them again. Now, Francho, replace the degauss circuit in the programmer. And then reset the programmer at exactly 10 2/10 seconds. This time we must not fail to remove the emotional characteristics. Our only hope of recovering our original creation is to be sure that this brain is a pure calculating machine.
So, plot-wise, very straightforward. A scientist is disgruntled, slightly whacked, because he's fired by NASA, and so he decides to have his revenge by creating Astroman from the dead body parts of criminals. However, his creation goes berserk and on a killing spree, attracting the interest of not just the CIA, but also an international spy ring. It's complete hokum and nonsense, but it's great good fun. And it's got some pretty good special effects in terms, at least as far as the masks go, and this. And apart from the John Carradine himself as a doctor, he's got a sexy spy in the form of Tura Santana.
Yes.
Great wardrobe.
Yes.
Where do we know her from?
Well, most of all from Fast the Pussycat Kill Kill, I would say.
Yes.
And she's a great looker and super fun. And well, we have been talking a lot about trying to get the films from by Russ Meyer, but it's a tough one in terms of rights. So we won't go into deeper into that, but we're still looking.
Yeah, no, one day we'll definitely get there. We've also got Wendell Corey, one of his last films. I think he was paid in whiskey for this role. Not great acting, but for somebody who starred against Barbara Stanwyck, you know, this was a interesting end to his career. And what else is there to say about it?
I mean, well, of course, Mr. TV Michaels also directed The Corpse Grinders, which we also have on Cult Picks.
Also on Cult Picks, indeed, and Doll Squad. He even made sequels to it, three of them afterwards. Mm. And it is one of those films which so bad it's good or just plain bad. Some critics have put it up there or down there with Plan 9 from Outer Space and or, you know, even worse films, which we've already agreed isn't the actual worst films. Ever.
No, absolutely. And also it's been super influential in terms of, for instance, music. I think there's bands and I mean, I made a playlist on Spotify for this week. And I think there were at least three or four songs called Astro Zombies.
Yes.
And I just remembered there is also a band called Man or Astro Man.
Mm.
Also from
add that
from
to the playlist.
Disc. Yeah, will do.
It's also got, if that's not enough for you, there are boobies in the nightclub sequence where the cops go to meet the secret agent spy ring. And Tura Santana is there. Why don't we have a little listen to the nightclub sequence?
What did I tell you? Is he terrific? I love that chick.
It's a great idea.
I'm jealous.
Oh, I love you too. Why do you have to get me in trouble all the time?
Well, it's your girlfriend.
She is with two others, her and another man.
You are to observe only, then leave the club before you're seen.
If you don't mind, I must thank yours.
But I do mind. You are to leave now. Return here immediately.
And we're going to return to the nightclub sequence, nudie boobs scene later on in an Italian setting. So keep in the back of mind, there's a bit of a thread running through here. Now to the brave new future of A Boy and His Dog. Yes. American film from 1975. Black comedy science fiction cult classic. By
Don Johnson from Miami Vice.
I know. I'm thinking this must be his biggest film prior to becoming, you know, pastel famous in Miami.
Yeah.
But
he's not a boy here, is he? He must be.
No, he was already well into his 20s, not a teenager, much like Mark Hamill in the next film we'll talk about.
Exactly.
But the real star, actually two stars of this, are probably the dog and the author. of the source material, none other than the great science fiction and fantasy author Harlan Ellison, who I was quite obsessed with when I was younger, not only reading his books, especially short stories, but also his musings on Hollywood. He's got a very sharp tongue, and he never quite had... He made a very famous science fiction episode of Star Trek called The City of the Edge of Forever, I think, but he never got that sort of wide recognition because none of his books became into really, really big films. In fact, this is probably his most famous one, and we're going to get on to a little bit about why. But effectively, it's about a America Southwest desert after World War III or World War IV, never quite clear, and a teenage boy who's roaming the vast and very desolate landscape with his telepathic dog, Blood. And as the tagline says, is the year is 2024, a future you will probably live to see. Which, given that it's 2023 now,
yeah.
Hopefully we will both live to see it. Yeah. But obviously, it was 50 years away when the film was made. So this was the directing debut, I think, of L.Q. Jones. And he financed it through his own company for about $400,000. And it is a fascinating in terms of the casting. They wanted originally James Cagney to be the voice of the dog, Blood. Yeah. But it would have been too distracting because he was too famous, simply. Right. So after they auditioned hundreds and hundreds of actors, they settled on Tim McIntyre, a great voice actor. And the amount of celebrities or famous people involved with it is quite astonishing because not only do we have Jason Robards popping up in it, L.Q. Jones himself has a cameo in a porn film that screened at some point. The music is partly done by Ray Manzarek, formerly of The Doors, responsible for the music. And this is my favorite thing, the dog, Blood,
is the most famous person in the film.
Until Don Johnson did Miami Vice, but Blood was bigger because he was the dog Tiger from the Brady Bunch TV show. Wow. So I love the fact that he goes from this wholesome family sitcom to being this foul-mouthed, cynical pussyhound sidekick, bloodied mouth in this post-apocalyptic science fiction thriller about a boy who is effectively, this is Don Johnson, hungry and horny in equal measures. The other thing that fascinates me about it is just how many films and the impression, even though it didn't become a huge hit, it wasn't a Star Wars, it did become a genuine cult film because it's cited as an inspiration for the Mad Max film, especially the first one, The Road Warriors. And if you see it with the kind of tricked out cars and the desert landscape and the kind of, you know, weird characters that populate this landscape, it clearly was a major influence for all the makers of Mad Max, including Miller himself. That's so primarily
cool. Yeah,
but Harlan Ellison says the writing also must have influenced Cormac McCarthy's The Road, although it's never acknowledged, and there is definitely that too. And finally, though I'm not so familiar with it, the video game Fallout is said to be on many levels, from underground community of survivors to glowing mutants, inspired by a boy and his dog. So why don't we take a listen to the start of the film, when the boy and his dog, who communicate telepathically, so I'm sure you can work out who the dog is and who Don Johnson is, when they chance upon a abandoned settlement underground.
You're still constantly overreacting. I have absolutely no idea how I've managed to keep you alive so long. And I wouldn't bother going down in there unless your taste has changed radically. They left an ugly mess. I said they left a mess.
I heard you.
Pearls before swine. All my directives go completely unregarded. Sometimes you're just as ignorant as any other common rover. What indication of a female at all? Caution to the wind. The eyes glaze, the glands swell, and the brain freezes.
I can't see a thing in there. Smell it.
No, I thought you were doing all the scouting today, Vic.
Damn it, Blood, don't give me a hard time. Smell it.
It's clean.
What fascinates me, one of the things about this, is that the MPAA ratings board originally wanted to give the film a PG rating, maybe because they thought it was a cute kind of Benji Lassie kind of boy and his dog. The title is really ironic. Film, but the filmmakers were smart enough to tell the rating board to give it an R rating instead. So maybe it would have been watched more and traumatized the generation of young kids.
Yeah.
But it did get an R rating. And it is famed for being misogynistic. It is definitely a exploitative view of women in the post-apocalyptic. You know, this is not Mad Max Fury Road kind of neo-feminism. But Harlan Ellison himself was very down on the final line of the movie, and we're not going to spoil it by revealing what it is. But he came to accept that even though it didn't appear in the original short story and novella, it was more fitting for the ending of the film, even though it caused a lot of controversy. So if you want to have an idea of the kind of tone of the film and how women aren't maybe not getting the best, you know, deal in this post-apocalyptic world, take a listen to this dialogue between Don Johnson and a woman he comes across in one of these underground shelters.
What's your name?
Vic.
Vic what?
Just Vic.
Well, then what are your mother's and father's names?
Boy, are you a dumb broad. I told you to stop looking at me like that or I'll bust your teeth out. Now get that stuff off. What's your name?
Quilla June Holmes.
That's a weird name.
It's not. My mother says it's not that unusual back in Oklahoma.
And the exploitative went as far also, I'd say, as the ad campaign. So if you look at the poster, that will tell you something also about the tone of the film. But it is a classic, cult classic. It's definitely worth checking out, not just for a very young Don Johnson and a Brady Bunch dog talking telepathically to him. It's beautifully shot and beautifully restored. Do watch it if you haven't done so already.
And then we have another star that he had actually become famous when he did this, and that's Mark Hamill, the year after the first Star Wars film.
Yes, and I wonder if Star Wars had already been released when he filmed it, or if he was still fairly unknown and still to, you know, achieve this kind of global superstardom of Luke Skywalker. Probably not.
No.
Corvette Summer came out in 1978, was a bit of a drive-in classic. And so Mark Hamill is a California teenager who works in a car shop where he builds his own or pimps out his own Corvette, which Corvette Stingray, which is stolen. He finds out it's in Las Vegas, so he sets out to get there, but not having a car, obviously can't get there easily, so he hitchhikes, and which he meets his co-star Annie Potts along the way. Not as famous as Mark Hamill, though you will recognize her from films such as Ghostbusters, where she was a secretary, or Fashion Ladies, I think the TV show was. Anyway, let's have a listen to, first of all, the scene where Mark Hamill catches a ride with Annie Potts' character on her way to Las Vegas.
What are you going to Vegas for?
I'm looking for my car. Somebody stole my Stingray, and the word's out it's in Vegas.
You've got a Corvette?
Oh, sure. It's a nice van you got here.
Yeah, really. But you can't tell from up front. Go on back and check it out.
Nice. Who did the work?
Some friends of mine, you know, in exchange for services rendered.
Services? What kind of services?
You know what I mean. Hey, bring us up a couple of cold ones, which, and we'll talk about it.
So, what are you going to Vegas for? A summer job?
Uh-uh. Full time, sugar, from now on. Hey, how old are you? You know what I'm talking about. You've met girls like me.
this.
I'm a hooker, for Christ's sake.
I love that squeaky voice. I'm a hooker, for Christ's sake. But she did get a Golden Globe nomination for her first ever feature film role, and obviously went on to have a good career after that in several things. Yeah. It's a film that was very popular, obviously, by car obsessive. There's a long history about what happened to the special cars that they designed and built for the film. And it did quite well at the box office. It took $36 million on a budget of under $2 million. So it wasn't a Star Wars, but apparently Mark Hamill is quite fond of the film. Mm-hmm. And so he looks back on it and says it's quite nicely written romantic film, and he enjoyed it immensely. It's a really charming film, real fun for car, classic car enthusiasts. It is particularly a favorite, but anybody can enjoy it. So after the grimness of A Boy and His Dog, why not give A Corvette Summer a spin? From the romantic to the erotic.
This is probably one out of the, I don't know, the 10 most famous or classic erotic movies, especially from the 70s. Debbie Does Dallas.
I think it is the most famous adult films that we have. I'm sure eventually maybe we'll get around to them, but you think of the other ones like Deep Throat.
Yeah,
Difficulty with Rights.
Yeah.
Devil and Miss Jones.
Behind the Green Door.
Behind the Green Door.
Yeah.
But
this is definitely one of them. And obviously it was a big success as it spawned, I don't know how many sequels.
It sold over 50,000 copies on videotapes. It became the most successful porn film of its time. And it's definitely from that golden age of porn. So it's got high production values for this kind of film, a fair amount of good acting. It's got an actual plot and script. So you can watch and appreciate it on many, many levels.
And also a great restoration. It looks beautiful.
Beautiful. It caused certain controversy, one of which was where it was shot. Wasn't actually in Texas, but it was at a Brooklyn College athletic field and the State University of New York, including the library scene, which sparked an investigation about how they got access to this and filmed this film on a reputable college campus. And more importantly, even though they are not named as such, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders also took them to court and argued that the uniforms were copied and therefore infringing on the Dallas Cowboys trademark. And this has kept the film out of circulation for a while, but obviously it's here now.
Fantastic.
And we have to thank Echelon for that. Also, you discovered that Debbie does things musically.
Yeah. I was quite surprised, as I don't know how you translate that to the stage, but it was actually a off-Broadway musical version of it.
Yes. Apparently some people were disappointed when they went to see it and discovered there wasn't any actual sex or even much nudity.
Yeah.
It has lived on since. It's been restaged several times. Some of the stagings have been a little more risque.
It has some really enjoyable songs, and you will find a bunch of them on our Spotify playlist.
Right. What clip have you selected for us to listen to from the original Debbie Does Dallas?
Well, I have selected a very interesting piece of music, because there's a lot of music in the film, some really, really good sort of pop rock music. But this is like a super psychedelic freak-out musical crescendo of a locker room sex scene.
We'll be right back. The shadow of Star Wars looms very big in this episode, and I think that's because the films are all around from that time, and we forget just how much of an impact it had. Obviously, The Exorcist and the Jaws were the first kind of really big blockbusters, but Star Wars just took it to a different level and obviously inspired everybody else to try to cash in on that success, and mostly failing, but in interesting ways. So it wasn't enough to have a swords and sandals epic, as we have many, many Hercules films before, but they had a new American star. And they saw, because swords and sandals had really died off by the 70s, hadn't they?
Yeah.
And we had the whole Ray Harryhausen.
It was very much a 60s phenomenon.
Yeah, so what better way to bring it back than have some technical wizardry and special effects? So you have an evil wizard who uses science, which I don't remember in the original Greek mythology. And so they're trying to do a mashup effectively of successful recent films like Clash of the Titans and Conan the Barbarian from 1981, so 2 years before this, with a sprinkling of Star Wars kind of technology and magic, and hoping that somehow it'll be the best of both worlds rather than a pretty... Maybe we should not the most successful mix-up. It's definitely interesting. And, of course, it's from the great minds of Golan Globus and the Canon Library. So originally it was meant to have a lot of very prestigious talented old, such as Ennio Morricone doing the music and Claudio Fragasso as a screenwriter. Didn't happen in the end. Instead, the responsibilities for writing and directing it went to Luigi Cozzi. Why do we know him on Cult
Picks? Well, he's obviously a quite notorious Italian director, but we have one of his films, and that happens to be the one I watched, actually last night, and that's Star Crash, which is a really, really blatant knockoff of Star Wars, where there's even a laser sword just like the ones in Star Wars, but with less budget, of course. And some pretty funny animations where it looks like they painted right on each frame of the film.
Yeah.
Lots of fun.
And we'll get to the best special effect in a minute, but fairly ropey in this one. However, it doesn't need to VFX the muscles on the lead, Hercules, because who do we have popping up as the half-man, half-god?
Yes.
None other than...
Lou Ferrigno, the Hulk from the TV series. And also some... I think they made 2 feature films out of some of the episodes as well and screened them in theatrically. Yeah.
Here he's not green. He's just very, very ripped. And what I loved, I found out a quote from him. He said that when I was a kid, I used to watch the Hercules movies over and over and over. My father would come into my room at 2 a.m. and I'd be watching Steve Reeves on the television. He would scream at me, "All you do is watch Hercules. Why don't you get an education, Louis? You're just wasting your time with that stuff." And of course,
and then
he had the last laugh on his dad. Yeah. The problem with that, though, was that he was obviously warped by having watched the kind of 1960s, very traditional kind of Hercules. And apparently at one point, Lou walked into Menachem Golan's office, having read the original script for the film, and which was quite liberally sprinkled with gratuitous violence and sex, and told him the script was, quote, a piece of shit, and threw it in the garbage. Because what Ferrigno wanted was a family-oriented kind of fantasy, much like what he'd watched on television,
right,
which is what eventually got released against Golan's wishes. And originally, and this was revealed by Sybil Danning, who's terrific in it, in Electric Boogaloo documentary, that there was a more adult version of Hercules planned. So he was going to be an R-rated blend of adventure and erotica. It was more blood, more guts, more nudity, more sex. But Lou Ferrigno, and especially his wife Carla, turned it into a kiddie film. Now, what you really wanted is you wanted to have something like Conan the Barbarian with Arnold, which, much more blood-soaked, much more nudity. Instead, what you get is you get Sybil Danning with this amazingly constructed dress holding up her cleavage in a fantastic way that, the effects couldn't compete with. But apart from that, it's fairly tame on the sex front.
From the depths of space comes the strongest man on Earth in the Super Adventure Odyssey. Hercules. The incredible Lou Ferrigno is Hercules. In a battle with unearthly creatures, Hercules, the superhuman hero, with the strength of an army. Hercules facing love and the bewitching forces of evil.
Fairly friendly family stuff. Now, what they should have done is they should have given more screen time over and more gratuitous shots to Sybil Danning. Just here to this short clip of what it is that she's got planned for Hercules.
We'll keep him that way until we're well out to sea. Then we'll feed him to the sharks.
So we'll never know, but obviously the film was not the kind of star-making vehicle for Lou that Conan the Barbarian was for Schwarzenegger and all the other kind of muscle mountains of the 80s, like Sly Stallone, Dolph Lundgren, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and so on. And therefore, kids, the lesson is don't go family-friendly.
This man has $6 million worth of heroin. It belongs to the mob. And all it will cost him is his life. American International Pictures presents The Italian Connection.
The plot, what is on offer, is pretty much offered straight off the bat, where the New York mob boss instructs his two goons about what needs to happen.
The man you've got to kill is Luca Canali, a small-time Milanese pimp. He used to be a runner for Don Vito Tresoldi. But when they decided he was too gentle for their tastes, they let him go. Now he has a crew of 10 or 12 hookers. Now, I want you to kill him in the most brutal way possible, because I want it to be conspicuous, sensational. I want it to be the talk of Italy, not just Milan. I want everybody to know that two Americans came all the way from New York to look for him, and that they tracked him down, and ran him into the earth like a cockroach.
So there you have it. A small-time Italian pimp has stolen heroin shipment from the mafia, and now the New York mob are sending over two hitmen to make an example of him. One of the hitmen is white, the other one is black. They travel as a team. Now, what I didn't know, and again, this shows points to my lack of cult film knowledge, is that the two characters, the two New York hitmen, Woody Strode, played by Woody Strode, and Henry Silva, were the inspiration for Quentin Tarantino when he did Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield in Pulp Fiction in 1994.
Wow, I didn't know that either. That's so much. It's going to be so much fun to watch this film with that knowledge in mind.
Yeah, and you see it, and you definitely realize, yes, of course, it's so obvious once you know it. Just how they riff off each other, the chemistry between them. Okay, they don't have black suits and ties, but apart from that, it's pretty much all there. And this was the second in a kind of trilogy director Di Leo, which were taken from a short story, Milan by Calibro 9. And you don't need to have watched the previous film and the second film. This one can be enjoyed on its own. Yep. It was shot on location in Milan and the Rome's Deer Studios. I didn't know. Not as famous as Cinecittà. Mm. And another funny thing about it is because they had so many different actors on this, they had Irish, they had Americans, they had Italians, that they had to perform all of their dialogue in English. And so if you watch the English language dub, which is what we have, for once in an Italian film, the dialogue and the actor's lip movements actually sync up.
They match. It's amazing. That doesn't even happen in a Fellini film.
No, Because he would film actors and then he'd write the dialogue, wouldn't he?
Exactly.
So they would just sing rhubarb, 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 rhubarb.
Yeah. That's so fun.
Let's have a listen to a bit of the nightclub sequence. Remember, we talked earlier about the nightclub sequence in Astro Zombies. This is a very similar one in terms of cops or hitman being there. A lot of boobies and their girlfriends and ladies.
You know that girl?
Who?
The tall one with the blue wig.
You mean Trini? Yeah.
Yeah, Trini. Have her come over and join us.
Well, I guess I can ask her, but I can't guarantee she'll accept.
Is she a pro?
No.
You mean that she's not a hooker?
No, she prefers protest movement.
Well, would you ask her to join our movement? Look, tell her that I will give her 100,000 lira if she'll come and have a drink with us.
I'll try.
Do you think she'll join us?
I wouldn't be surprised. It isn't every day some idiot offers you 100,000 lire to have a drink with him.
So this is 1972, and therefore you get a bit of smart aleck political commentary about Vietnam, very off its time. But of all the films, I'd say they're all good in different ways. I love Corvette Summer as kind of romantic car comedy. But this one is probably the most well-made film. It is gritty. It is thrilling. It's got some great chase sequences, both in car and on foot. And there's a rawness to it that you can definitely see what it was that Quentin liked so much about it, that he would be inspired by the kind of two lead characters in probably his most famous film. We've got one final film for you on this episode, and it takes us to Mexico.
Indeed.
We should have asked Adrian for his opinion on this one.
That's right. Yeah. But I think this is one of the classics of Mexican horror from the 70s.
Mm. And it's called Night of a Thousand Cats, also from 1972, same year as Italian Connection. So watch them and compare and contrast. Playboy who flies around in his own helicopter, and boy does he fly around a lot in the helicopter.
Yeah, I read a review film. Someone said it should be called The Night of a Thousand Helicopters.
It was. Anyway, as a tool for picking up beautiful women, having your own helicopter is obviously a major babe magnet.
Yeah,
so
it always works for me.
Yeah, I you know, this is where I've been going wrong all these years. So he gets these women, takes them back to his mansion, castle, villa, whatever you want to call it. And spoiler alert, it doesn't end well for the women. And guess how he can afford, to feed thousands of cats while staying a millionaire. I'll let you work out that for yourself. I don't think they could actually afford 1,000 cats for the film.
I read somewhere... I read somewhere someone reviewing it, giving it really a bad review, say, it's not 1,000 cats, it's only 70 cats. And then in the climactic scene, there's only 10 cats, but in different angles.
Yeah. And somebody's clearly obsessed enough about cats to actually freeze frame and count them all.
Confirm if that, you know, was real, if it was a real live cat, whatever, what happened with the cat. But It's a little heads up that he didn't have any qualms about using animals like that.
Exactly. Not a trigger warning as such, but definitely a heads up.
Yeah.
So I think that strings it quite nicely together because you found the common thread there from dogs to cats.
That's right.
We've done the bar scenes. We can find something in this mishmash of titles, genres, countries, years, and actors that unites them all, other than, of course, all being from our lovely friends at Echelon Studios.
Yeah.
Well, boys and girls, ghouls and goblins, that's all we have time for this week. And your head is probably already spinning more than Regan's in The Exorcist from sheer whiplash in terms of genres and different types of films that we've got for you these past 7 days. So next week, as we said, settle down and just enjoy some quality 70s mainly, I think, German smut. You've been listening to The Culpix Hour, as always with me, your host, Django Nudo.
And The Smut Peddler.
Why don't we end by listening to a little Debbie Does Dallas music number.
What's the matter, Rick? Lady trouble?
Yeah, why so blue?
Well, fellas, it's like this. I'm just a guy, like any other guy. I wanna have sex. Don't ask me why. My girl is hot and she's pretty nice too. But now that she's working, I don't know what to do. I wanna do Debbie. Debbie's what I wanna do. I wanna do Debbie. Maybe her and Lisa too. I wanna do Debbie. Dumping her. That's it. Whoa.